Hello there, welcome to this episode of Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with me, Ken MacDonald. I'm a former director of public prosecutions and a barrister practicing at Matrix Chambers in London.
And with me, Tim Owen. I'm also a barrister at Matrix Chambers, specialising in crime, public law and human rights law. So in this week's episode, Ken and I wanted to focus on the death penalty and torture. We want to examine where the world stands in 2023 in relation to the long-standing efforts by human rights campaigners to abolish the death penalty worldwide. And we also want to discuss what some say is the unfinished business of holding the UK to account for its past complicity in torture conducted abroad by foreign state agencies. And we also want to look in that context at the provisions in the National Security Bill, which has, I think, recently completed its amendments in the House of Lords, the provisions which some NGOs have warned will provide unacceptable protection to ministers from future involvement in torture or complicity in torture by the UK security services. And our guest to guide us through these issues is Maya Foa. Maya is the Joint Executive Director of the legal action and human rights NGO, Reprieve. She joined Reprieve in 2010, was appointed its director in 2015, and Joint Executive Director in 2020. She originally studied French and Italian at Oxford University and contemplated, or perhaps she carried out, I'm not sure she'll tell us, a career in theatre and directing, but eventually did a postgraduate degree in law and eventually ended up in Reprieve, where she, as I say, continues to this day. She's a World Economic Forum Young Global Leader. She's been expert advisor to the European Commission and has been garlanded with numerous awards in recognition of her human rights work. Maya, welcome to Double Jeopardy.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
Welcome, Maya. It's a great pleasure to have you. And full disclosure, I ought to say that I'm a patron of Reprieve and was its chair between 2011 and 2017. It's very good to see you again, Maya.
So, Maya, we'll get on to the heavier subjects that I've outlined in a minute. But we usually begin our episodes by asking our guests to just say a little bit more about themselves, about perhaps a bit about your background and how you ended up where you are today at Reprieve. So tell us a bit about your background and education and so on.
Sure. So yeah, my route to Reprieve was an unconventional one. You mentioned various stages and different iterations. I studied French and Italian literature. Like many, many people, I thought about the law for a long time. Many people suggested I go in that direction. And as a child, actually, from quite a young age, I was really concerned about, you know, I knew the power of the law, but I also knew and felt strongly that it could be used as a tool to uphold structures of inequity that I had witnessed myself as a kid coming from I had two immigrant parents, one in particular who was extremely vulnerable and had suffered quite a lot in the UK for various reasons, including within the criminal justice system. So I rejected it for a long time, studied, you know, literature and art and had a fantastic time at Oxford, and then thought that, and still think, that art can be a route to change the world. I was very political and I started off in theatre, did a couple of productions and then realised I wasn't happy. And I think if you're striving for something like, you know, to have a career in the arts, to be a director, and then you get a little bit of success and it was humble success and you're not happy, you've got to get out because it's not the right place to be. And I wrote to Reprieve as an organization I had spotted doing its work on Guantanamo. It was really outspoken, fantastic, actually, in the early days of Guantanamo. And I wrote and I said, can I be useful? Really, that was the end of my plan. I'd had a serious bereavement the year before. And I think I was really just looking to go somewhere, do something helpful. And in the first weeks of being at Reprieve, we were filing a judicial review against the British government. And I realized that I could use law in a way that was pretty, impactful alongside the other tools at my disposal.
Maya, you referred to your parents both coming, having immigrant backgrounds. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah. So my father was Malawian, and the family has been in Malawi for a number of generations. They were South Asian Muslims originally, and they emigrated over to Malawi. And he came to London to study law, which he did for a while, and then he became a poet. But he got very, very unwell when my mother was pregnant with me. He had TB and meningitis, was in a coma, and then brain damaged, and lived in, you know, he didn't die then, he lived for 13 years, but a very, very unhappy 13 years. And my mother was Italian Jewish, and the family had left Italy in the Second World War and ended up scattered. So they were, you know, wonderful people who had met at International Students House in London and had this very multicultural, they had a set of friends, or not really my father, but my mother retained this set of friends from that time. And so I had all those influences. And then I saw, which was great richness and one of the great things about Britain, and then I saw some of the harder aspects of being a brown man perceived to be Muslim and unwanted in the country.
So a very interesting and understandable background as someone to become interested in human rights issues, I would think.
Yes, I think so.
Tell us a bit about REPRIEVE as an organisation. Lots of people will have heard of it, but just give us a sort of a nutshell summary of how it came into being and the kind of range of work it does, and also sort of where you stand within what is obviously quite a crowded field of human rights NGOs.
Sure. REPRIEVE was founded nearly 25 years ago. Next year will be our 25th anniversary. And it was founded by two people, one of whom, Clive Stafford Smith, was a death penalty lawyer working in the Deep South, British, American now, but he had been working in the Deep South of the US as a capital defense attorney for decades, wanted to come back to the UK and continue his work on the death penalty. And then he partnered with somebody called Paul Heyman, who's a filmmaker, who was on the original board of REPRIEVE, and I'm sure Ken knows well. So they worked together. The reason they met was that Clive was working on a case, a death penalty case in Mississippi, case of Edward L. Johnson, who was a black man on death row there, and he was fighting to stop his execution. And Paul Heyman did a documentary with unparalleled access, actually, to the court process, to the execution chamber, and to Clive the lawyer, and of course to Edward. And this documentary charted the last 14 days of his life in May, and he was ultimately executed, and the documentary caused, rightly, just huge concern about the state of the death penalty in the US. And a lot of people in Britain supported it, wanted to find a vehicle to try and help push for abolition, and around the world, not just the UK. And Clive and Paul got together, I think it was in the pub, and scribbled down, you know, the name REPRIEVE, and it started from there. So we were very, you know, small beginnings, and we've grown massively over the last, I say massively, we're a medium-sized organization, we're 43 people, but we've grown massively from those two people in the pub.
It's the most extraordinary film, 14 Days in May, and actually it's on YouTube. I do strongly encourage everyone listening to this podcast, if they haven't already seen this film, to go onto YouTube and watch it. I mean, there are many remarkable things about it. Perhaps the most remarkable thing is that almost everyone around Edward Johnson in the last days of his life, up to and including the warden of the prison, really believed that he was innocent. And believed that an innocent man was being executed. And it's the finest anti-death penalty statement I've ever seen. And it's a wonderful piece of work. And it's quite understandable that the intensity of that brought Clive and Paul together in the way that it did. And REPRIEVE is really, in many ways, the product of that film.
Absolutely. And actually, the way we work now, you know, we use the law, of course, we have to. We're working on torture, death penalty, other issues of extreme abuse of power and human rights. But we also are creative, and we have to use other courts. We have to use the court of public opinion. We have to use an artistic courtroom. We have to continue to work the political courtrooms. And to do that, you have to bring in the different tools at your disposal. So documentary, film, theater, of course, you know, the media. And that is one of the strategies for REPRIEVE.
And so you referred to litigation as well. So the combination of work is both campaigning work, as you say, campaigning in the court of public opinion, but also strategic litigation.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're a casework organization, so we have clients all over the world on death rows or facing extreme abuses in the context of so-called counterterrorism. and we are working on their individual cases. Sometimes that's public, sometimes it's not. And then we bring bigger pieces of strategic litigation where we can to impact the landscape on the issues we're working on.
I mean, Reprieve started out as purely a death penalty organisation, and shortly before I joined, there was quite a big debate on the board, and this may have been before your time as well, Myra, as to whether it should branch out into other types of work as well. And I think it was Guantanamo as much as anything that really drew Reprieve's interest. And of course, Clive was very interested in Guantanamo, and that became quite a focus for its work, didn't it? The appalling situation at Guantanamo and trying to do something about it through the law.
Absolutely. And one of the things that Clive would say, and it is true of Guantanamo and other contexts where we now work 20 years on, all of those individuals were facing initially potential death sentences. So there was a thread, a practical thread through thematically to the death penalty. But it's also about the way states treat people who they're putting beyond the law, either because they're trying to exile them or because they want to execute them, or in the arbitrary detention without charge or trial context of Guantanamo. And these people are people who states have decided to hate for whatever reason. They have pitched them as the worst of the worst. The current worst of the worst are the people we call terrorists. Some of those people are clients of mine in Saudi Arabia who were 15-year-olds when they attended a protest and administered first aid. And the attendance at the protest and the administration of first aid at that protest is written on a charge sheet labeled terrorist offense. And then the 15-year-old is sentenced to death. So I think it would have been a debate at the time, but for me, thematically, for Reprieve, it makes complete sense that we would be looking at how, if we want to hold power to account and uphold the rule of law, which is part of our mission, how states treat the people domestically and then outside of their own territory that they are casting as the worst of the worst, often for political reasons, as we know.
Let's move on. I said at the beginning of this episode that we wanted to look at where the world stands in 2023 in relation to the death penalty. And in preparing for the interview, obviously I've done a bit of research, and in some respects the story is an optimistic one of progress, in the sense of a decline in the use of the death penalty. I mean, we're not going to, in this episode, have a debate about whether we think the death penalty is a good idea. I mean, we all think that it isn't. It's not moral, it's not humane, it's not a deterrent. But obviously that view is not universally shared. But if you look at the US, the Death Penalty Information Centre headlined in its report for 2022 that public support for the death penalty in the US is at a near record low, and that's despite the perception that violent crime is up. That last year was the eighth consecutive year with fewer than 30 executions and only 50 new death sentences. At the same time, numerous examples of botched executions and so on in particularly Alabama and Tennessee. But that the executions are heavily concentrated in the US in a few jurisdictions, in particular Oklahoma and Texas. I hadn't realized that Oklahoma was such a addicted to the death penalty. And worldwide.
And fewer states as well, Tim. So yeah. This is one of the great successes in the states, that more and more states have opted out of the death penalty or in a state of moratorium on it. And that's been a significant development over the last 15
sure.
or 20 years,
sure.
I think.
And just to complete the stats before I ask you to comment on it, Amaya, I mean, according to the last statistics I could find, the top 10 countries conducting the most executions in 2021, with China at the very top, and there's God knows how many take place there because there's no accurate data about how many there are, but China, Iran, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Somalia, Iraq, Yemen, the USA, and South Sudan are the top 10. So that's just some statistics to begin with. But where do you see Where do you see us, and where do you see the campaign that you've been involved in for so many years with Reprieve? How is it progressing?
Just before you answer that, I mean, setting it out the way Tim just has, the USA is really not in very good company there, is it?
That's exactly right. And actually, what I'll start by saying, the direction of travel is good. Countries move away from the death penalty. We've seen that over decades and increasingly rapidly in recent years. I won't go into the stats, but I will focus for a moment on the continent of Africa, because in your list, there were very few African countries in your top 10. And that's not a surprising fact when you look at the direction of travel in Africa. It's one of the continents with the fastest rate of abolition at the moment. The large majority of countries don't execute and or have technically abolished. And over the last few years, five additional countries have abolished the death penalty. There's huge progress being made in Malawi towards abolition. I mentioned Malawi earlier. Reprieve has been very active there. Zambia abolished, Chad abolished, Sierra Leone abolished, all in the last few years. So there is massive momentum on the continent. And what I find so interesting about that is that it's really being driven by local actors, civil society organizations, of course, but also decision makers. And they are saying the death penalty was a colonial legacy. It came in because of colonialism, and it is not part of our justice system. I can speak to Malawi quite, you know, with a little bit of authority on that, because Reprieve has worked there and also my family's there. You know, the death penalty was never part of the Malawian justice system before the Brits arrived. So this move to abolish, some people talk about the work of organizations like Reprieve and other people working against the death penalty as a kind of potentially neo-colonial or a Western importation. It's not. In this context, it's Malawian stakeholders who have been pushing for abolition and then enlisted the support of other organizations who can bring different things to the table. But the movement on the African continent is away from the death penalty. And I was reading recently something from one of the Sierra Leonean organizations who abolished. They were saying, you know, America should be looking at us. We're the ones who are going to the humane practices. We are the ones who are thinking about justice in a way that's restorative, not retributive, which I think is it's an interesting angle on this and a lens through which to think about different countries that isn't often applied, partly because of the way the media likes to report on the state of the world. But just one more example, you know, in the US, and the death penalty is on the decline in the US, and we can talk about that because it's a special interest of mine as well. But in the US, having somebody in prison, in the prison industrial complex, privatized prisons, they are making money for this, for capitalism. They're making money for the state or through these private enterprises. There is a rationale for having mass incarceration in the US and the death penalty. In Malawi, one of the greatest arguments against the death penalty is an economic argument. The value of a human life in Malawi, we talk about life being cheap in certain countries, it's not. That human is much more valuable back in their community in general than they are in prison. And that's one of the motivations that tribal leaders and some of the political stakeholders in Malawi have given for abolishing the death penalty. You can get people off death row, you can get them out of prison, you can get them back being valuable within their communities. So I find that very interesting to look at. You can read so much about a country from their justice system and how they treat the people who are the most vulnerable in society or the people who other people have chosen to label bad.
I mean, that's interesting what you say about the Malawian, the value of how a human life is regarded. It occurred to me that whichever society you're looking at, in the end, the imperative which will drive a society to do away with the death penalty as an acceptable sentence is going to be that very attitude to human life, whether you are persuaded that it's immoral and not effective as a deterrent. But really, it's the immorality of it, perhaps, which is the most important conclusion that you have to come to. And I suppose I think in the end, that's something that will take time in different societies. But there are some societies, clearly, where, and I'm thinking here of China and Saudi Arabia, to take two examples, where quite clearly it would seem we are a long way, or they are a long way, from reaching that conclusion that this is a disgusting, immoral form of punishment. And I suppose I wonder, you talk about the death penalty in certain societies being seen as a colonial imposition, but that's not true, for example, in the case of China, or probably not in the case of Saudi Arabia either. It's to do with a view of punishment and the acceptability of executing somebody as a punishment for a crime, including crimes well beyond murder. I mean, in China and I think in Indonesia now and other Asian countries, drugs offences attract the death penalty in huge numbers.
This is very interesting. There are questions of sovereignty and self-determination here. When I was DPP, I used to meet quite regularly, actually, with my counterpart in China, who was the federal, if you like, chief prosecutor for the whole of China. He was quite an interesting man. He was, you know, as in the context of that time, quite a liberal. He was pushing through a new criminal procedure law, which gave some basic rights to defendants, for example, to call witnesses and to be represented in certain types of cases. But he was aghast at the idea that the death penalty would ever be abolished in China. And he used to say to me, look, you know, we've got billions of people here. We don't have state structures as developed as people outside think. And this is an essential mechanism of social control, which is hugely supported by the population. I mean, very little anti-death penalty sentiment in China. I think he's right about that. I think most people in China strongly support the death penalty. So how do we approach that? I mean, how do you have a conversation with a Chinese woman, Chinese man, a Chinese citizen about the death penalty, why it's immoral, why it's not effective, why it's not efficient? What does that conversation look like?
So I think I'll talk about Saudi Arabia and then some of the other Southeast Asian countries. China we don't work in, and I'll come back to China, but I think it's instructive actually to talk about real life examples, real case examples that we've worked on in jurisdictions where we can get in. If you can't get into a jurisdiction, you can't really do much active work. That's the reality is I don't send reprieve places where we will either not help or do more harm than good, and that may be the case in China, but it is not the case in, for example, Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is, we just put a report out saying, you know, some of the bloodiest years of Saudi Arabia's history have happened under, and bloody in terms of executions, under the new crown prince, not so new anymore. That's true, and the numbers are high. At the same time, we have seen individuals who were facing execution, in fact, were sentenced to death for protest-related offences. The three cases of three young men, Ali Dawood and Abdullah, who were sentenced to death for attending protests, again, administering first aid at protests. There are also people who've been sentenced to death for attending funerals in Saudi Arabia. They were children at the time. We worked on those cases for many, many years and very actively in as many courts as we could get to, soft and hard law, soft law mainly in Saudi Arabia. And ultimately, the law was changed. The law on the death penalty for children was changed with a juvenile decree, which was passed in 2020. Ali Dawood and Abdullah benefited from the terms of the juvenile decree, which said that the death sentence must be commuted to a term of years, and they are out. And Ali has just completed a university degree. And all of the rhetoric in Saudi Arabia, now the reality does not reflect the rhetoric right now, and we are drawing attention to that, but the rhetoric is important. The Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, has been saying Saudi Arabia is no longer executing children. We do not have the death penalty for juvenile offenders anymore. Is it true in all cases? We don't think so at Reprieve, so we're going to continue to work on it. Is it significant, though, that that individual who we might say doesn't need to purport to be upholding human rights values that maybe we in the West, that he needs to say that? He doesn't, and that's come from inside. So to the question of what cases do you raise, we worked very, very closely with colleagues at Reprieve and at our partner organization, which is the European Saudi Institute for Human Rights. They identified the kinds of cases that would move hearts and minds in Saudi Arabia. And they may not be the same cases that would, you know, energize people in Britain, but we identified them, we amplified those cases, working really closely with the people who could speak to us on the ground. And that did bring about changes within Saudi Arabia. The same is true in Singapore on a death penalty case, a recent death penalty case of somebody accused of drug offences. He was intellectually disabled, very, very vulnerable, a migrant worker. And there were protests, the first protests we've seen in Singapore against the death penalty, a country which I mentioned because there too, if you spoke to the AG they would say there's overwhelming public support for the death penalty, which is it's true by polling, but we all know we can poll. Reprieve can poll people, you can poll people, and the results can be different depending on the question and also the case that you're using. Bad cases make bad law, we know that. Good cases can bring about huge changes.
But I mean, it's one thing, of course, to persuade a country it's not a good idea to execute children or mentally ill people. It's another thing to persuade them fundamentally that this is a form of punishment that just has no place in any concept of civilization and decency. And I mean, how can you really see in your lifetime or ever countries like China and Saudi Arabia coming to that view?
I wouldn't put it in those terms, though. Hmm. I don't think that saying the death penalty is immoral or uncivilized or any of those things, for me, and I've worked on this for, you know, 14 years, that's not the argument I'd start with. But, you know, maybe at a dinner party with you two, potentially we could have that, but not in a jurisdiction, many of which are very, very sophisticated and civilized, where they use the death penalty. What you do, and I think we did the same in Britain ahead of the 1950 commission that resulted in ultimately the abolition of the death penalty, is you point out the errors in the system. And then you question with, we might say, yeah, sure, the state can have the power to kill. Then we say, well, hang on a minute, take America. If you are getting it wrong, if your error rate is as high as it is, and we know from exonerations of people who were formerly on death row that it's high, if you have such problems with racial discrimination and inequity in terms of power, and we say those without the capital get the punishment, which is true by the numbers, if you have innocent people being executed, can we really countenance that then we need to keep, and then you also layer in the argument you said before about it doesn't actually have a deterrent effect, one. Number two, it's really expensive in the US. Now that's a US-centric argument, but my point is we have to tailor, if we're to be sophisticated about this and achieve our goals, which of course I think certain goals are achievable in certain countries, then will be full abolition. In some countries, there won't be, but there will be a significant reduction in executions, which is what we want. Then we have to be really thoughtful about the right arguments for the right context, as you would be in any other forum where you're having a debate.
I mean, I think that's all absolutely right. I must say the only time I ever heard real anti-death penalty sentiment expressed in China was when during one of my visits, there was a big front page story in all the newspapers. It concerned a man who'd been executed some 10 years previously for murdering his wife who disappeared. And then during my visit, she reappeared in the village. And she'd been off visiting someone and one thing had led to another and she'd just disappeared for 10 years and this man had been executed. Now, this led to an editorial in the People's Daily saying, you know, this is disgraceful, we have to take more care, the innocent man was executed. And I did at that time, during that week or so, have conversations with people about the death penalty that were quite fruitful. And I think you're also absolutely right about the United States. The two key things that have driven change in the United States have been the phenomenon of the exonerees, since the Supreme Court said that people on death row were entitled to DNA investigations and a number of people were released who've been on death row for many, many years. These people became television celebrities and that drove a huge change in attitude. And the other thing is the research that makes it absolutely clear that if you're poor and black, you're more likely to be executed than if you're even poor or white, and certainly much more likely to be executed than if you're rich and white. I think those two things have been very significant. So I think these pragmatic arguments are the arguments to be made, not great moral arguments about the death penalty. One thing I wanted to get onto, Maya, because I think it illustrates two things about Reprieve. One, that your work is incremental and it's battle by battle. It's trench warfare, if you like. But also that Reprieve is very agile and imaginative and sometimes quite funny in the way it does its work. And that's the Lethal Injection Project. And this is a project that had a huge impact on the death penalty in the United States. I think it led one Texas senator to describe Reprieve as the most dangerous organisation in the world, which I'm sure you'd like to be in one respect. Could you just say something about the genesis of the lethal injection project, the targeting of a European pharmaceutical company, the story of the Acton driving school and all the rest of it? Because I think that says a lot about your work and about what works and what doesn't work.
Absolutely, and with delight. And I'll just lead by saying, if states move back to the firing squad, and just to hold in our minds, is that a bad thing in the US? So on the lethal injection, this was 2010 when I first started at Reprieve, and I mentioned we, you know, within a few weeks we were in court asking the government to put an export control in place on a drug called sodium thiopental. And the origin of that was a Thursday night, and there was an execution scheduled in Arizona. And the lawyers in Arizona had found out that the drugs that were due to be used had come from somewhere else, and they thought from England. So a call comes into the Reprieve London office, and I'm sitting there in the corner, and there's somebody says, well, does anybody have half an hour to do a research task, try and find out where this drug might have come from? And I said, sure, let me have a look into that. And I worked solidly for the next, whatever it was, 7 hours, and I figured out a few things about the drug. One, it was probably not a good quality drug that was made for the US market. It could have been a counterfeit drug. It could have been, you know, from some other country. And two, and it could have also been veterinary. So I figured that out. Sent that over to the lawyers, and they managed to, and formed an affidavit, and they managed to get a stay of execution that night for the individual. I went home, thought this was great, went to bed, woke up the next morning to the World Service saying that after a brief stay of execution, Jeffrey Landrigan had been executed by the state of Arizona. And that was then that was a real wake-up call for me, that the states would use this drug that we knew was probably bad, could have been veterinary, could have been something else, and use it to kill someone, regardless of the fact that that could have been torture. I'm bringing you back to the question of the death penalty and torture. So I investigated it further and did locate the source of the drug ultimately. It was the back room of a driving school in Acton, and the driving school was called Dream Pharma, or the pharmacy within it was called Dream Pharma, and they were noteworthy for a couple of things. One, selling execution drugs across the US, which was a new gig that Matt Alavi, the owner, had got into. And also, I seem to recall from investigations, counterfeit Viagra and a few other investigations. So a really reputable place, the kind of place you really want to be getting your drugs from for something as serious as the death penalty. And the second thing that I learned in investigating this was actually that the companies who make these drugs, they don't make them for executions. These are normal pharma companies. These are...
One was a Danish pharmaceutical company, I think.
Lundbeck, yeah.
Anti-epilepsy, yeah. Anti-seizure drugs.
Precisely. So we got this export control in the UK, and we did that by essentially proving that the only exports of the drug were for the purposes of capital punishment. We don't have capital punishment in the UK. Why would Britain be facilitating the death penalty abroad? It was a legal case. We probably would have lost if we continued, but we won because we won politically, and we won politically because of the work we were doing publicly around the case.
I remember having a conversation with Vince Cable about this, because he was then the Trade Secretary, and I said to him, you're supposed to be a Liberal Democrat. What the hell are you doing?
And he
said, oh yeah, what am I doing? And then they,
exactly.
They said, okay, and it worked.
Exactly.
It was just a brilliant idea, and it worked. And they slapped an export ban on this drug.
So then the states couldn't get that. I went to Europe. I got an export control across Europe on the same drug. That continues to this day. Then the interesting piece from my perspective, and the perspective of kind of how you do human rights work creatively and nimbly, and you're attacking these big problems. Not gonna try and tell the governor of Texas it's immoral to have the death penalty. I could, won't go anywhere. What I did do was figured out how to work with the pharmaceutical industry. These drugs are medicines. They're made to heal, not to harm. They're made to save and improve the lives and health of patients. If you look at any pharmaceutical company's website, they've got a statement that says X company advances health and saves lives, all of them. I had discovered in the case of the Arizona execution and the drugs from Dream Pharma that these companies didn't make the drugs for use in executions. They didn't want to have anything to do with executions. But at that stage, they were neither prepared to take action, nor, and this is critical, did they have the mechanism to do so, or at least they purportedly didn't. So when states moved to the new drug, pentobarbital, I sat in the same corner of the same office and tried to imagine what I would do if I were the CEO of a pharma company and I didn't want my drugs used in executions, which is what they say, but I also needed my drug to be sold to all of the legitimate patients. They had created this false dichotomy. They said, oh, you know, it's such a shame our drugs are being used, but we have to serve all these patients. So, you know, we can't possibly block it. That didn't make sense to me. And I figured out how, in other circumstances, companies direct, they design supply chain controls so that drugs only go to approved users. And that might be for safety reasons. It might be because they're commercially expensive and, you know, they're sort of new drugs and they're trying to trial certain things. But the US pharmaceutical distribution system is extremely sophisticated. And I designed a new distribution model to ensure that Lundbeck's drugs only went to legitimate healthcare providers and not to execution chambers for use in executions. Convinced the CEO, who sat opposite me at the table after I'd done a bunch of other things, including putting a lizard on the table in a press conference, which harkens back to the theater days, that the point of that was to demonstrate that you wouldn't be, the point, you know, the fact that you would not be legally allowed to do to a lizard in the state of Texas what you are obliged to do to a prisoner when you put him to death.
But also, Maya, wasn't there an episode when you discovered the same in relation to dogs, that people stood outside the headquarters of the pharma company cuddling puppies? You're in there making drugs for executions, and we're out here cuddling puppies, and that kind of thing caused a lot of grief for those pharmaceutical companies who did not want to be associated with this in any way, shape or form.
And what's happened since then, that was 2011, the CEO, to his credit, actually, and I'm not one to normally dose out kudos to big pharma, but in this circumstance, that CEO sat opposite me, his comms guy started to say why they couldn't do ABCD that I proposed. I had the leading business journalist and paper who, you know, also working with me on this, Ulf Winberg, CEO, said, wait, why can't we do that? And then they did it and it worked. Those controls worked. So now there's 50 plus companies who have all put out statements saying they oppose misuse of medicines and executions, and they've implemented distribution controls. So states aren't able to lawfully buy those drugs. And it's not actually because people are vilifying the companies. It's because the solution is there for the companies to take. And it's now industry best practice. So what we've seen is a sea change. States clung on to lethal injection despite the fact that they couldn't then get pentobarbital. They moved to multiple other drugs. That implicated, you know, Pfizer, Johnson, GSK, all of these companies. They know that there are ways to protect their drugs from being used in executions. They know that there is a fiscal, reputational, potential legal cost to having your drugs used in executions these days. They implement the controls, they put the statements out, and they communicate to states that they've done this. Where that gets you is a lot of states are unable to carry out lethal injection executions. And when states stop executing, that's not the argument that wins hearts and minds against the death penalty, but it does create the space for the advocates who are talking about innocence cases, racial discrimination, poverty, the impact of those harms in the criminal justice system to then push for full abolition, which we have seen in Virginia, where there were no executions, partly because of lethal injection issues, in Louisiana, in, you know, other states, Nebraska abolished and then brought it back. But so it's had real impact. And then a few states saying, well, maybe we'll move to another method, which brings back to that question, is it a bad thing? My position is if they move to another method, there will be fewer executions if they use it at all. States don't want to use these other methods. And what we know, I find really intriguing, is that according to polling, support for the death penalty drops in America depending on the method of execution. So if it's lethal injection, it's high. If it's firing squad, it goes lower. If it's electric chair, it goes lower, and so on. So states know this as well, the decision makers. There's a reason they've clung on to lethal injection despite being sued by pharma companies, despite the cost, you know, skyrocketing, and the huge incidents of botched executions that you mentioned.
Yeah, well, and that chimes with what I said at the beginning, quoting the statistics and background to last year, which is the declining support for the death penalty in the US. Can we now move from death to torture. One of the cases that I think your reprieve is involved in is the case of Jagdar Singh Johal, who is a British blogger facing, I think, the death penalty in India after allegedly being tortured into giving a false confession. And I think Reprieve were involved last year in exposing or alleging that MI6 may have been involved in tipping off the Indian authorities in his case. Now, of course, we know it's been accepted publicly that in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, the UK's intelligence services were in some instances complicit in the use of torture by the CIA and other foreign agencies, and that despite a series of inquiries since 2010 and some reforms of the system, questions remain about whether enough has been done to prevent future British involvement in the torture of detainees. And perhaps we'll come on in a sec to just look at this provision in the National Security Bill that I think Reprieve have expressed concern about. But can you just tell us a little bit about Reprieve's involvement and your experience in this field of UK complicity in torture abroad?
Perhaps, Ma, you could do that also in the context of the Belhadge case, in which it is admitted by everyone that the British security services were complicit in rendering that man to almost certain torture and abuse in Libya at a time when we were cozying up to Gaddafi. I mean, that's a really scandalous case.
And that's exactly it. That's where some of this started. Reprieve was investigating extraordinary rendition and torture, really from the outset of the post-9/11 war on terror, quote, structures that were put in place and that everybody jumped onto. And Abdul Hakim Belhaj and his wife, who was pregnant at the time, Fatima Butcher, Abdul Hakim was a Libyan dissident who had been living in exile during the regime of Gaddafi, as you said. In 2004, he and his pregnant wife were detained and tortured by the CIA in a secret detention facility in Thailand, and then were rendered to Libya, where Mr. Belhaj was tortured for 6 more years. And it emerged in 2011 that the UK had played a key role in their abuse after faxes found in Tripoli literally showed senior MI6 official officer Mark Allen congratulating Libya's intelligence chief on the couple's, and I quote, safe arrival in Libya, and claiming that the intelligence about Mr. Belhaj was British, again, a quote. So Mr. Belhaj and Ms. Butcher initiated, with the support of Reprieve and others, civil proceedings against the UK government for the involvement in their detention and rendition. And after years and years, in 2018, after years of civil litigation, the Prime Minister, Theresa May, gave Mr. Belhaj and Ms. Butcher an unprecedented apology in Parliament, accepting that the UK government's actions had contributed to their detention, rendition and suffering. So very, very clearly, we were mixed up in the wrongdoing. And that was because in the aftermath of 9/11 and the desire to catch people who we perceive to be bad guys, a lot of our normal principles, a lot of our, you know, safeguards, guardrails were thrown out, and politicians were given, or they felt, or they took license to break the law. And we know the position on torture. We don't need to go over that. It's not derogable. You don't get to contribute to torture. And right now, as you mentioned, I think we're seeing a reprise of that. So we had an apology, we haven't had a proper inquiry, and now we're in a new iteration of sort of war on terror frameworks. Sometimes it's the Indians, terrorists, and I'm using inverted commas, and sometimes it's the UK's so-called terrorists.
To be frank about this, it's not very likely, is it, that this Belhadge case was the only incident. I mean, it's not very likely that they only did it once and just unfortunately got caught on the only time they did it. I mean, this is more likely to be an example of behaviour that was taking place at that time, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. It was an extraordinary set of circumstances that led to that trove of documents being discovered, and that, you know, bit of information after the fall of Gaddafi being captured by people and able to be brought to light. So certainly systemic, and no reckoning, no real reckoning.
But can I defend Her Majesty's government and refer you, Maya, to the principles relating to the detention and interviewing of detainees overseas and the passing and receipt of intelligence relating the detainees. So this is a document published in July 2019, precisely in the wake of the cases that we've just been discussing, Belhaj and others. And it set that this 16-page document sets out these following principles. I think, in fairness to Her Majesty's government, let me just read them out and you can then say what you think. The UK government does not participate in, solicit, encourage, or condone unlawful killing, the use of torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, or extraordinary rendition. In no circumstance will UK personnel ever take action amounting to torture, unlawful killing, extraordinary rendition, or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. The UK takes suggested incidents of this kind very seriously. These allegations against UK personnel are investigated, and complaints in this context are brought to the attention of authorities in other countries, save where to do so might itself lead to unacceptable treatment of the detainee or the safety or security of the UK personnel, raising the concern may be put at risk. In relation to rendition, the UK opposes any form of deprivation of liberty that amounts to placing a detained person outside the protection of the law, in addition to its opposition to torture. UK also opposes unacceptable standards of arrest and detention. UK takes great care to assess whether there's a real risk that a detainee will be subjected to unlawful killing, torture, cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, extraordinary rendition, or unacceptable standards of arrest and detention. The UK's aim is to develop and promote human rights in those countries with which it deals, consistent with the lead the UK has taken in international efforts to eradicate the mistreatment of detainees. And these principles apply to the UK's intelligence and security agencies, members of the UK's armed forces, employees of the MOD, officers and staff of SO15, Metropolitan Police Service, and officers of the National Crime Agency. So, I mean, the government's case would be, yes, bad things happened in the past. Those have been exposed and litigated, albeit, of course, in some cases, in closed material procedure cases under the Justice and Security Act. But we've learned lessons, and here are our new principles. What do you think?
Well, so I listened to all the principles, and they do sound good. But what we actually know is that the government's principles on intelligence sharing, which were, it used to be the consolidated guidance, which was the policy on torture at the time of, for example, Jagtar Singh Johar's arrest, which I'll get on to, there is the discretion, it purports to give ministers discretion to authorise the intelligence agencies to pass information over, even where there is a real risk that torture or unlawful killing will occur. So there is a loophole, and I would say a deliberate loophole, that still enables ministers to essentially sign off on things that could result in torture or serious mistreatment. We have been campaigning to get that loophole closed for a really long time, alongside others, including Ken Clark, who, as chair of the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Extraordinary Rendition, called for the document to reflect the, and this we're talking about the principles when they were being formulated, the document needed to reflect the absolute prohibition on intelligence sharing where there's a real risk of torture, which is really just to bring it in line with the international law position. So it sounds good, but the reality is, if you have a loophole that enables ministers to sign off on intelligence sharing where there's a risk of torture, it may well be used. And that is, we've seen the case of Mr. Belhaj, and we are now seeing this same discretion being applied in a case of a young British blogger who has been subjected to extraordinary torture in India, potentially thanks to a tip-off by UK agencies, potentially with the sign-off from UK ministers.
Do you accept there's a difference when it comes to the British state using information from overseas that might have been obtained by torture overseas? In other words, us using that information. I mean, obviously we don't use evidence in court that has been obtained by torture, and we had an absolute prohibition on that when I was DPP. But what about using and acting upon evidence that's emanated from abroad, which might have been obtained abroad by torture? If that information, for example, could lead to the arrest of people planning a terrorist outrage in the UK, or even help to prevent a terrorist outrage in the UK, in those circumstances, it's right, isn't it? And can be appropriate to use that sort of material, even if it was obtained by torture.
There goes to the fundamentals of what we, the question of why we oppose torture, which of course is, it's moral. I'm not going to move away from that, but it's also, critically, that it doesn't produce good or credible evidence. I mean, that is another very real pragmatic reason.
It might do.
But you don't know that. And the fact of the torture invalidates, that's why it's inadmissible. It invalidates the potential. You can't possibly know it. So take, for example, the rendition cases and Guantanamo. A lot of people ended up in Guantanamo, nearly 800. And a lot of them based on intelligence, and again, I'm putting that in brackets, that was received from individuals who had been tortured. You say anything.
Yeah, but what if, I understand that. But what if you have some information, say, from Pakistan that may have come from a man who was tortured, that there's a group of people somewhere in East London building a bomb? And this is the address. This is the address. I mean, surely in that
investigating,
situation.
I think investigating evidence that you've received, of course you're going to investigate in most circumstances. But that's actually not really where we're going with the work that Reprieve's doing on British government ministers trying to take more and more license, it seems, with the national security bill that's being pushed forward now, to grant themselves effective immunity impunity from participating in or encouraging.
Is that true, Maya? Because, I mean, I think we'll just get on to this now, perhaps, before we wind up. There's clause 23, it was. I don't know if it's clause 28 now in the bill, as it currently stands. But that amends the Serious Crime Act 2007 to remove criminal liability for the offences of encouraging or assisting crime, but only where that activity is necessary for the proper exercise of the functions of the security intelligence agencies or the armed forces, and only in support of activity taking a place overseas. And the aim, say the government in the explanatory notes, is to enable the UK intelligence services and the armed forces to collaborate with key international partners more effectively to support UK national security objectives. But clause 23 does not create a blanket criminal law immunity for intelligence officers. It doesn't change the application of all other criminal law offences which overlap with those under the Serious Crime Act 2007, including those criminalising torture anywhere in the world. So offences such as soliciting murder, misconduct in public office, secondary liability offences all continue to apply. Also, Clause 23 does not apply to provide protection to rogue officers who act outside the scope of their proper duties, and it doesn't remove potential civil liability or other routes of legal challenge, such as the ability to bring a claim for judicial review, a civil damages claim, or a referral to the Investigatory Powers Tribunal. So I'm not quite clear that it does do exactly what you say.
Let me be very specific then. Actually, what you've just described is a concession. So the original version, and this was a lot of work by a lot of organisations, including Reprieve, the original version would have granted effective immunity from prosecution and basically disenabled certain aspects of the Serious Crime Act. So, and it didn't need to do that, and it's now been amended. That was quite a lot of work to get there. So do we still have concerns that the provisions are broad and that there's no absolute prohibition on specific facilitating or encouraging specific offences, including torture, cruel and human degrading treatment, and sexual offences? We do have concerns about that. We'll continue to push for it. Of course, we want things, these safeguards, to be stronger. And we should, whilst still acknowledging that prosecuting authorities and governments will want to be able to operate well overseas. Let me take it into a slightly different context for a moment, because we can go into the nuances of that bill. It probably will pass. We've had really significant concessions, which are important because the original version rightly caused outrage because, you know, ministers shouldn't be, this division between a rogue officer and a minister, I want ministers to be held to a standard alongside, actually, officers if they are complicit in, it shouldn't be totally exempted from the Serious Crimes Act, and they're not going to be now. So, but to take it to another context, I work in Pakistan on the death penalty. We've worked there for many years. As we know, there are limitations to how much Britain can do from a law enforcement perspective on crimes, drug offences or drug trafficking because of Pakistan's continued application of the death penalty for drug offences. We worked really closely with agencies in the UK, with agencies including the prosecuting agency for drugs in Pakistan and our partner organisation. And then we did a lot of work surveying death row for drugs. We got to a point where, because the UK government was slightly, its ability to work effectively, to collaborate effectively on drug trafficking with Pakistan was impeded by the fact of the death penalty. The prosecuting authority in Pakistan said, actually, in order to facilitate law enforcement cooperation and better prevention of crimes related to drugs, and because we don't think the death penalty, proven by these reports that we had done, is effective for drug offences, we are going to remove it from the statute book. These things are complicated, but actually relationships, law enforcement relationships, Ken, you know this better than most, you can have complicated conversations and you can find middle grounds that involve us upholding our human rights principles and the things that we say really matter in Britain, whilst also being able to collaborate. Yeah. And sometimes that brings about really positive changes in the global world order.
Well, I certainly agree with that. And certainly when I was DPP, I had many conversations with people, security people, prosecutors in Pakistan and other countries, and their practices weren't always our practices, but we thought it important. It obviously was important for us to maintain friendly and constructive relations with them as part of our fulfilling our national security function at home. I mean, Clause 31, it's actually Clause 31 of the bill in the House of Lords, Tim, is very, very different, as Myra said, from Clause 28, which came from the Commons, which, as Myra said, gave an immunity from the provisions of the Serious Crime Act to security personnel operating abroad. And Clause 31, the House of Lords clause, provides a defence, which is a very different thing. I mean, it seems to me that it is just inevitable that security service people operating abroad will sometimes carry out acts which, if they'd carried them out in the UK, would have been illegal here. I think that's just inevitable. I mean, burglary is a very good example. And there are two questions that arise. One is proportionality, and to what extent is the act necessary? How grave is it? I mean, obviously, some acts will be beyond the pale and unconscionable. And I think Clause 31, the House of Lords clause, is an attempt to grapple with the question of proportionality. But the second question is the extent to which those who order these acts, those who control these acts, are themselves accountable to democratic institutions. And I think it's in that area that we've still got some way to go. But I don't suppose that Reprieve is wholly in agreement with me on this. It's complicated.
Subject for the next discussion.
Yeah, well, Maya, I would love to give you the right to reply. We could keep going on and on, but I think we're going to have to wind up this session. But no doubt we can get you back to continue the discussion with other issues. I had hoped we'd get on to the subject of the past offences of Governor Ron DeSantis, who it seems played a rather dodgy role as a naval lawyer in Guantanamo in 2006. And the Washington Post have just done an interesting story revealing that. But I'm afraid we're out of time, and so we'll have to move on to that on another occasion. But Maya, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a really interesting discussion.
Thanks for having me. Lovely to get to chat with you both.
Thanks, Maya. You've been listening to Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with Tim Owen and me, Ken McDonald. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation. If you have, please subscribe to this podcast, share it with your friends, and join us again in the next couple of weeks when we'll be bringing you another episode. Our editor is Billy Lawrence and our social media advisor is Jess Jones.